is an emotional and primitive man.
Do you remember when we met? Suddenly, we were together.
Lee Marvin is Walker, the hunter and the hunted.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Holmes Movies Podcast. My name is Anders Holmes, and I'm joined by Adam over Skype.
Hello. Sorry. Yes. It's in the flesh. So Skype has gotten so good that it could actually transport me to Denmark and put you right here in your living room.
I've gotten so used to saying over Skype.
Yeah. Yes, I'm still here. I still have a cold. It's almost like we're recording two episodes back to back, but, you know... Don't tell the listeners that. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah. I'm good.
That's a weird way of saying it. All right, so...
How are you?
Well, you know how I am. I've got a cold, I'm tired, and I've got to get on a plane in an hour, so...
Yeah, you got some travelling to
do. I do have some travelling to do, but anyway...
Bit of the planes, trains, and automobiles.
Really, very, very much so. In fact... All three will be involved at some point in the next 24 hours. So we watched a film last night.
We did watch a film last night. Yeah, we felt like watching a movie, and we picked a really interesting one that the both of us really wanted to watch because it has one of our favorite actors in it, Lee Marvin.
Lee motherfucking Marvin. Friendly Fire have previously expressed him, and I can't now think of Lee Marvin without his full title of Lee motherfucking Marvin.
Yeah, we talked about another one of his films, The Dirty Dozen.
I feel like he's come up a lot. He's a bit of a household hero. I'm not sure if we've talked about The Big Heat or if we've talked about...
We haven't talked
Seven
about
Seven Men. I think we've probably discussed them in the context of Westerns, like Seven Men from Now and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. But we should spend some time with Lee Marvin today. Is there any other business we need to cover now that I'm here in the flesh, so to speak? Any news?
Yeah, a little bit of news. James Dean.
Oh yeah, he's having his long-awaited comeback.
He's having a huge comeback. Yeah, a director or some two filmmakers or something. They're making a film. I think it's to do with the Vietnam War.
And yeah, I think so.
Something with PTSD or something like that. And I don't know. I just found it really weird that they searched high and low for the right kind of actor, and then they ended up picking a dead person.
Yeah, for people who aren't familiar. These two filmmakers, I can't remember their names. They are making a film about something or other set in the 50s or 60s. They put out like this interesting statement where essentially they said they, as you say, searched high and low. They literally looked at everyone, and they decided that James Dean really was right for the part. This, you know, despite the fact that James Dean's been dead for getting on for 70 years, but. Never mind. They forge ahead. The estate is happy for them to use his likeness, so they're going to do a CGI and stock footage with some other actor reading his voice. So actually, they haven't searched high and low for an actor, and found James Dean. They've only found half of James Dean. They still need the voice, which So
I think the response that they got was
what are their names?
The directors, just trying to find an article with their names on.
Well, in any case, it's...
Where is it? Sorry.
At Google. I know. Anyway, it doesn't really matter what they're called, but I don't know. My gut reaction to this was pretty pretty strong, and I feel like that's been the same with most of the other pieces of commentary I've seen, both in the newspapers and on social media.
Yeah, I think a lot of people kind of... were like, why that? Why do you have to do it? Like, why him? Why can't you just pick someone who's alive or something like that? Yeah, the directors are called Anton Ernst and Tati. Sorry if I'm going to get your name wrong, Tati Gulick.
Well, guys, think about someone else. Think about a different course of action. I mean, because this feeds into this whole debate about de-aging and CGI and bringing people back from the dead that's been kind of going on for a while. I mean, as you. Rightly mentioned when we were talking about this offline, like the the Tupac hologram.
Yeah.
You know, other there's lots of other examples of it. You know, we had Peter Cushing appeared in the Star Wars movie,
which was odd.
Which was odd.
But
yeah.
Also, like, the CGI really stood out in a way. And not in a good way, because, like, that sort of thing was, like, you could have just have gotten, like, a Peter Cushing lookalike, or maybe just...
Or an actor who could do a passable Peter Cushing impression, and every single Star Wars fan would have forgiven them, because the guy's dead. Like, it's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a little bit...
Sorry.
Like, you know, you can edit things like that out.
Yeah, I know.
It's just it's like everything is live. Everything you hear is days of the podcast.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm probably going to make some hideous noises as well along the way, which you probably should edit out. Actually.
Yeah. I think like the response that they put out after everybody was like, "You what?"
Well, what did they say?
They basically, I can't remember exactly, but it said like they were surprised that it was so negatively received, and they were sort of saying, it's not a gimmick.
Well, it is. This is the thing. It's like, this is what's so stupid about their statement. It's like, we've searched high and low and decided on James Dean. It's like, okay, well, hang on a minute. Like, A, the guy is in 3 films, so you've got a very, very, very shallow pool to draw on. And also, like, no, you clearly haven't, because if you've decided on James Dean, that is the gimmickiest gimmick of the gimmicks. Like, the guy was famously in 3 films. He's an icon of culture that very few people have actually really interacted with beyond... Like, most people are familiar with the photographs. Most people may have seen one of the movies. I don't think there are that many people who've seen all 3. He's become a sort of cultural icon because he's very, very handsome, and he was very, very cool at a time when, you know, it was pre...
you know, when leather jackets and fast cars were cool.
Yeah, exactly. And it has a certain amount to do with a certain kind of, like, grease... fueled like nostalgia, that sort of 50s happy days nostalgia as well. And he was very, you know, clearly quite an interesting, soulful guy. But he's been, you know, mythologized just to bits. And so, I mean, I just don't, it just, like, ethically, it's creepy as hell.
Yeah.
Bringing someone back from the dead without their prior consent. I mean, yeah, so the estate does exist to arbitrate this sort of thing. So I can sort of get that to a... But you're really... The problem here is that it is... Even if you... If I'm going to believe them, take them at their word, that they set out with the best will in the world to really try and find someone, and they just got this idea in their head, they couldn't shake it, it had to be James Dean. It was like, they're visionaries. And obviously, they have total creative freedom.
Yeah.
You know, no one else is breathing, you know, looking over their shoulder, being like, guys... have you cast anyone yet? You know, if that's really truly what they believe, then still it is a gimmick, because you're not able to use the full performance. You have to use a guy doing a voiceover, which basically renders it a gimmick. And I think these guys sat down and said, we want to make a movie with James Dean. I can't see how else you would get to this point.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of a slap in the face for any other working actor, you know, today, who's trying to have their big break. Because these two guys are clear, like, from what I gather, I think these guys are sort of like up and coming people, or like they haven't had their big break yet. But I feel, I don't know, it's sort of like putting James Dean, like a well-known, as you said, an actor, you know, who was pop cultural, a real big pop culture icon, putting him on your poster with another actor who's maybe not, like, they're not, maybe the whole cast isn't like going to be filled with people they're bringing back from the dead, but and making it seem like some lost movie from the 1950s. But yeah, I think,
well, if you were going to do something like that, that's what you would do. But I think that would also be weird and creepy. I mean, the whole idea of bringing people back, I think, is really ethically thorny, because especially for people whose life was concerned with the production of cultural content, art, to sound really pretentious, like, that's those arcs, those careers kind of mean something as a whole.
Yeah.
And yes, James Dean's career is incredibly short, and he happened to make 3 really good movies in that time. But, you know, I just don't, there's no value to bringing him back. There's nothing that will add to his legacy. It's like, you know, it's like Queen continuing to tour with a different frontman. You know, it's like, well, you're not adding anything. In fact, you might even be detracting slightly. You know, yeah. It's definitely not adding value, and it could be causing, you know, depreciation of your, like, cultural cachet or whatever you want to call it. But so I've the whole thing makes me, predictably enough, I guess I'd be such conservative about this stuff, but like I just find it icky, and it's that whole way in which these processes are going to get easier and easier, and people are going to find ways to make, like, because they always do with modern technology.
Yeah.
It's like if you find you get something and it becomes easy to do and it becomes fun to do, inevitably you'll find a way to just make everything a little bit shitter.
Yeah, I think,
thank God George Lucas does no longer in control of the Star Wars movies. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, even for the new one, they're using, like, because I mean, Carrie Fisher is going to be in the film in some sort of form, but I think they're using like different takes from the other two films and then putting her in the film.
It'd be interesting to see how that goes. Anyway, we shouldn't go down the Star Wars rabbit hole.
Mm.
But yeah.
Yeah, well, that's our little bit on that. And maybe, I don't know, well, who knows if the movie's ever going to get made because of all the, you know,
I'd be surprised if they went ahead with it. Well, I suppose, I don't know, if you have that lack of self-awareness to put out the statement saying that you'd looked at every single actor in the world and decided on someone who'd been dead since the 50s, I don't know, maybe not.
Yeah, you got to have investors and produce people, you know, you have to have the money people behind that film.
I think money people will be all over that sort of shite. That's the normal thing. That, anyway, enough.
Yeah, let's move on to the film that we're going to talk about, which is the Lee Marvin film Point Blank, directed by a British filmmaker, John Borman. And this was his second film. The film he did after that was Hell in the Pacific with Lee Marvin and the Japanese actor...
Oh, Toshiro Mifune.
Yeah, Toshiro Mifune.
I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. What was his first film?
His first film was Catch Us If You Can, which in America was called Having a Wild Weekend.
Ooh, hello.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, no, it's... well, there's a lot to talk about here. So, I mean, there's a lot of people who will tell you that this is one of the best crime movies of all time. There's a lot of people who've written books about this. David Thompson, who often gets name-checked on this podcast, is a great film writer. He talks about this as one of his 10 favorite movies. So we were like really excited to see it. And for sure, it is different. And it is definitely a refreshing and new take on... a genre that by 1967 has certainly been done to death, you know, the whole crime, revenge, thriller, whatever you want to call it. But it has, I mean, it's not without its flaws, I would say. But I guess one way to, one way to look at it is to think about what did the films look like before this came out and what did they look like afterwards? And I think from the very first shot, it's clear to see that this film is not like anything else that was being shown in the mid-60s.
I think you could really... I think to sort of start with talking about the film, I think you have to sort of talk about how the movie is edited. Because the movie has a very unique editing style, which is very reminiscent of films of the French New Wave, like the way that François Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard cut their films together. If you look at something like Breathless... that has a very interesting editing style, which I don't know, like a lot of filmmakers, you know, those French New Wave filmmakers, they looked at a lot of American films and were inspired by them and did their own sort of thing. And then American filmmakers were watching their movies and thought, oh, that's kind of cool. Let's borrow some of that. And, you know, the director, Steven Soderbergh, he talks highly of this movie as well. And if you look at some of his movies... actually a lot of his movies actually in the early part of his career, they all have like that similar style. The editing is he was inspired by a lot of the editing for his movies, particularly The Limey, which is a crime film with Terrence Stamp, which has a very interesting editing style where, like, if you watch that film and then you'll clearly see, like, he watched Point Blank and just kind of borrowed that editing style and put it into his film, because it is very experimental, not in like weird and like psychedelic, but like experimental in the way that it's telling the story and the mood and things like that.
Yeah, he cuts around in time quite a lot. He uses editing as a way to call back memories that characters are having. He uses, you know, they'll jump from, you know, very suddenly, these very surreal shifts. There's the bit after he's discovered his wife's body, Lee Marvin, and she's taken an overdose, and you know, then it jumps all of a sudden to the bed being totally empty and stripped of everything. It's this very surreal kind of transition,
very dreamlike.
Yeah, there's a lot in this. I mean, the way the film opens, I was saying to you as we were watching it, like the first 5 minutes was like a brilliant short film, because it just tells the story of someone, you know, he wakes up in this prison cell and you think, oh gosh, he's in prison. And then you realize that it's an abandoned prison. And then you realize it's Alcatraz of all places. Yeah. And then you get told the story of how Lee Marvin came to be lying, you know, with a bullet in him in a prison, in an empty prison cell in Alcatraz. And it's done through, you know, voiceover, a little bit of narration, a little bit of, you know, back and forth. Like they start introducing these musical motifs, and they set the tone for the rest of the film, which is going to be very, like, in at certain times, it's going to have a kind of almost sort of stoned quality to it. And at other times, it's going to be sort of frantic and kind of... you know, desperate and sort of visceral, and
avoiding the exposition.
Yeah, heavily. Right. And avoiding and really like the minimal plot. You know, that's, I mean, we can come on to that. Like there are a few things that I would certainly question on that front, but it's clearly setting its stall out as like this is we're doing this in a new way now.
Well, they threw out the original script, like Lee Marvin and I think it was, he met John Borman when Borman was on the set of The Dirty Dozen in London, and then they talked about the script, which was based off the book by The Hunter by Donald Westlake, who in the film is called Richard Stark, and they liked the main character of Walker, who's just called Walker, played by Lee Marvin, but they didn't like the script, and they just, you know, threw it out, and then they basically, you know, came up with the story together, almost.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
And a lot of it kind of came through rehearsals and things like that.
I think it does have that slightly cobbled together feeling, both in a good and a bad way. Mm. But yeah, I mean, let's talk about Walker. Let's talk about Lee Marvin, because this is a film that I think only really makes sense with Lee Marvin in it. And Lee Marvin, who we love, is a great...
Yeah.
I mean, he's just one of the great screen presences. I mean, he looks like a mountain or a tree or something. He's huge. He's got this deep gravelly voice. He's a force of nature. He's completely unlike any other actor before or since. And actually at this time was having a huge
break.
Because of The Dirty Dozen, of Cat Ballou.
He was in The Professionals and The Dirty Dozen. Those are the two films he'd just done before. And then, you know, he followed that with Hell in the Pacific, which he did with John Borman. And then Painting a Wagon.
And he was living hard. He was partying hard, firing shotguns out of Las Vegas hotel windows and all the rest of it, I think, on the set of The Professionals, as possible. Like, I can't remember. I heard some pretty... I seem to remember reading some pretty nutty stories about him, his debauchery. But, you know, he was an interesting man who had been, you know, he'd been wounded in the Pacific as a Marine. He'd pretty, you know... He'd had a pretty rough time of it. And, you know, he'd for a long time, he was the sort of a bit part in Westerns and crime dramas, you know.
He was kind of like the, you know, that guy looks like a bad guy, put him in that role in a supporting lead kind of thing.
Well, sometimes he's a sympathetic, like he plays the classic Irish sergeant character in Pillars of the Sky, which is a sort of weird Western that we watched a long time ago, I remember. And he's just... had this amazing career, and you know, he's mostly known for playing characters with either grey or white hair, which I think is kind of great because he's sort of and though, you know, his greatest roles, quote unquote, are
anti-heroes,
you know, these but also just in the autumn of his life and of his career. It's a little bit similar in some ways to you know, to Gene Hackman, who didn't really... Like, Gene Hackman seems to have been like already in his like 40s by the time he became a star, and then just sort of aged gracefully since then.
Yeah. I mean, he always kind of, I wouldn't say he was typecast, but he always played the kind of gruff characters. I guess winning an Oscar for Popeye Doyle, you're always going to be end up playing Popeye Doyle type characters.
Yeah, I mean, you could definitely, there's definitely a bar somewhere where you could imagine like Gene Hackman and Lee Marvin and like, you know, Bogart and Spencer Tracy.
Cagney.
You know, well, Cagney's funny because Cagney's such a, he's more of a like little wiry kind of pistol of a guy, you know, but you, these big kind of lumbering blokes who, you know, like
shoot
Mitchum's
first.
Another one, you know. Yeah, not necessarily about how they behave, but it's more just sort of physically they're so,
Yeah, I think.
But like he's just, I think the whole idea with this is that Walker is a force of nature.
Yeah.
He's also a kind of a man out of step and a man out of time. And Marvin is, feels like he could be those things, or at least he plays it like, you know, and exactly like that. And I love the scene that really sets the tone for me is shortly after he decides to go on the revenge mission. He's like walking down a corridor.
Yeah.
And it's like intercut, him walking down a corridor is intercut with scenes of his wife who's betrayed him, having her hair done and putting on makeup and stuff like that. And it has this, again, you know, you talk about the editing because the footsteps create this rhythmic kind of pounding that then continues after we've stopped watching him walk. The way he is going, like just barreling down this fucking corridor, just, like determined look on his face. And it's like, it's weird because the corridor also looks like it's sort of in a, we don't really know what kind of building or airport. Yeah, it's very hard to know where exactly he is. So, but there's something in this sort of driven purpose that I think, you know, tells you that anyone who comes across him for the coming the next hour is going to be in serious trouble.
They're going to be sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then it's built up to that point where he bursts into his wife's house and then just runs straight to the bedroom and just fires guns and fires bullets into it, thinking that poor John Vernon is lying in the bed.
Yeah, I mean, it's that's an incredible moment, and they use that subsequently to, you know, in flashbacks again, which are brilliantly done, into the use slow motion really well. I thought the picture quality just on the DVD we were watching yesterday was actually brilliant. Like, it's been so well preserved. So I think there's got to be good versions of this film out there that people should watch. But it really helps when you're using techniques like that, that you are able to see that you have visual clarity. And so, you know, thank goodness that is at least you have a copy of this film that's a good watch.
I mean, it just shows that John Borman had a really good sense of like camera and location and shots and stuff, and knowing where to place the camera and what to get and things like that in regards to like the actors' performances and also a way of building tension and things like that.
Yeah, because I mean, there is obviously so much in this film that you know, there is a lot in the immediacy of the performances and the shots they get, but as you say, like this film is just as much about the editing. But yeah, and so it's like a computer game. You know, he has to complete all these levels.
He's going from revenge. One place to the next. He's sort of working his way up this ladder of this thing called the organization, which John Vernon has bought his way back into after they did, like in the beginning of the film on Alcatraz. It was actually one of the first films to actually film on Alcatraz.
Right.
And there's this helicopter showing up with money for a drop-off or something, which they end up stealing. And then John Vernon realizes, like, oh, this is not enough. I have to shoot Lee Marvin. And then Lee Marvin is left for dead.
Yeah, he basically kills... He thinks he's killed Walker and taken his money and used that to buy favor with this shady criminal whatever organization called the organization. And this is where, you know, the details are very sketchy about how all of this works, and even what these people were dropping off and picking up, and why you could just fly a helicopter into Alcatraz. So this is where the plot starts to get a little bit funny. And then you have this, you know, Lee Marvin has this kind of spirit guide who you think is a policeman, and ends up turning out to be the guy who's actually behind it all.
It's like Blofeld helping Bond.
Right, it's a little bit like Blofeld helping Bond. That's very well put. But also, it's also a bit weird. And
it,
And that, it's also, and actually, I will say, I saw it coming a mile off.
Really?
Yeah. I was like, I think.
You think that's Fairfax?
Or not, because the name starts to not matter. I was like, I just think that he's the main, like, there's,
yeah.
If there's a main bad guy, quote unquote, that's it. I need to stop saying quote unquote. That's really annoying. That's the main bad guy. I should just do air quotes, but then you wouldn't see them.
Well, that's what I do.
Yeah, well, that because you're a fool. excuse me, just having a sip of lemon sip. It's okay. You know, you don't necessarily need like a really well thought through yeah. criminal empire to make a crime drama work. I mean, the whole, if you think about Kaiser Soze long enough, you know, it doesn't really hang together. If you think about any crime drama that isn't really, really, really sort of detail oriented and maybe perhaps a little bit boring for it, you know, you're going to be able to pull on some threads and figure out there's something wrong here. But there's yeah. something very peculiar about the way this organization works. Like they seem to have this endless resources, but a completely hapless group of
idiots
of like henchmen in suits who constantly just get beaten the shit out of by Lee Marvin or arrested by the police or completely like, you know,
aren't exactly good watchdog dogs.
No, they're not good watchdogs. He runs rings around them. You know, he bamboozles them.
Yeah.
You know, ties them up. He, you know, and it doesn't. And it's all very, I don't know. It's not very personal feeling. And it's like a. It doesn't feel like and this
it
is the funny
like
thing.
Fever dream.
It feels like a bit of a fever dream, yeah. Right? But it also doesn't feel. You don't get to like really hate these people. You don't like, of course we don't like, what's his name? Mal Reese, who's played by John Vernon. We don't like him, and we also meet this car salesman, Stegman, who's also a total piece of shit. But like generally the rest of them are either just boring henchmen or these rather affable businessmen.
Yeah.
And actually, I think there is something, the film is doing that somewhat deliberately. Like the affable businessmen, the film is making the point that it's affable businessmen who are the real criminals in the world. And
yeah.
Well, you know, we can see that sometimes is in fact the case. And the film to some extent stops being about a revenge
fantasy
and starts being about discovering that, you know, crime isn't just like knocking over a till and running away with the money. That crime is a system. Crime is a business that has, you know, lots of people working in areas where they don't even know what they're doing to contribute to the crime empire. But
there's a lot of cogs in the machine and stuff.
Right, but I'm just not sure that it's funny that they choose to push those films together, because basically halfway through this movie, Lee Marvin gets the ultimate revenge on Mal Reese. Basically, he steals his woman, to use a term that they would have perhaps used back then. He then walks in on him having sex, tears him out of bed, and Mal Reese ends up falling off the top floor of a skyscraper completely naked, and that's the end of that. That seems like a pretty humiliating and way to go. But there's something.
I think that happened way too early in the movie.
Right, exactly. Like, why not explore the whole crime capitalism thing while also keeping us interested in this revenge drama? Because then it becomes suddenly he's just obsessed about getting his $93,000.
Yeah, I think the problem is like they should have had Reese more in the film, like have him play a bit, like just see what exactly does Reese do, and then kind of get a sense of the organization through him as Walker's trying to get, you know, revenge and
stuff. Why do they put up with him as well? Because he's clearly incompetent.
Yeah.
They give him a huge penthouse. They give him all this security. They let him, you know, enjoy himself left, right, and center with anyone he wants to lay his hands on. I mean, what is this guy so good at? Because basically all we've seen of it so far is that he's ever so slightly fucked up a robbery and then you know, killed his partner, and from then on in, it's just incompetence. The other thing I want to say, by the way, just coming back to the robbery thing, do you know at the end, Brewster says, played by the brilliant Carol O'Connor, you know, oh, give me the Alcatraz run is still open, we can get money that way. But, so if that's the organization's money.
Yeah.
Does that not mean that Mallory stole money from the organization in the first place? Like, does that just not hang together? Am I being stupid? Yeah, no, but I mean, am I being stupid there, or am I just?
No, I think I was just, I was watching it going like, isn't it? Huh? Yeah, I feel like that's a bit weird. Yeah, that's a good, that's an interesting point.
I'm basically a little confused by the plot, and that's where I think this film needs to be careful, because
it needed that original script that they threw out the window.
Right, I think it's a little bit too much style over substance, and that's fine and all. Mm. And I think honestly, like, I want to make it very clear, I liked this film. It was really enjoyable to watch.
It's a good film. It has some really, really good moments. And like,
yeah, would it have killed them to put in just a bit more sort of a breadcrumb trail that we could follow?
Yeah, there was still there was a little bit more under the surface of the iceberg that we kind of wanted to see.
Right, exactly. But you know, I think there's been a lot of writing about what exactly this character is and what he represents. Yeah. And you know, David Thompson even I think wrote an article once, kind of slightly tongue in cheek, claiming that Lee Marvin was just a ghost that was haunting these people and causing them to take overdoses and hurl themselves off buildings and, you know, shoot the wrong people. Just, they had freaked everyone out from beyond the grave. But I don't think the film is really implying that to any degree.
Well, Soderbergh, I just have the Wikipedia article up. It says Steven Soderbergh has described Point Blank as memory film for Marvin. Borman believes the film is about Lee Marvin's brutalizing experiences in World War II, which dehumanized him and left him desperately searching for his humanity.
I mean, there's something incredible in the performances. Mm. And I want to talk about the three central characters, which are basically Marvin, Mal Reese, and Angie Dickinson's character, Chris. And Marvin, yeah, throughout the film, he is like this unreachable kind of void of, you know, he's got a lot of rage, clearly, but he doesn't spend a lot of time shouting or growling. No. He just sort of barrels through stuff and beats people up, and he's very kind of quiet and brooding and passive, and solipsistic. You know, he is totally just like, you know, in his own
head
space, and doesn't sort of know anything beyond what he is immediately concerned with. It's like, it feels like this character, if he wanted a cup of coffee, he'd just like walk through the nearest wall and just grab one from a cup, you know,
steal one.
Yeah, or just punch someone who was walking over with a cup of coffee and take theirs.
Exactly.
There's that brilliant bit to that point where Angie Dickinson goes absolutely mental and basically slaps him and beats him and pummels him for like a long time, and he just sort of stands there and takes it. And then she sort of collapses to the ground and is like, "Ugh, finished." That's pretty wonderful. And I think is also perhaps a good, sometimes a representation of how the audience might feel watching this movie.
When watching the film, I was reminded of the fact that I think I've seen this movie before, but with a different actor and a different director and different cast. Oh. And that was the 1990s film Payback with Mel Gibson.
Well, the less we say about that, the better, probably.
Yeah. Well, John Borman had like a... Like, I can't remember what year it was, but John Borman was asked if he had seen the film, and he basically made a little kind of sly little jab at the movie, saying like, "I kind of feel like Payback... They must have had the script that we threw out the window, and then Mel Gibson was walking along and then picked it up."
Right. I mean, yeah, that's not a particularly good movie. But this very much is. I think there are interesting comparisons to make. One of which is with Bullet, because Bullet also has that slightly detached quality, whereas like Bullet's, you know, he is also a character who's kind of out of time and out of place, but it's sort of about so much about him. If this film is about Lee Marvin, Bullet's so much about Steve McQueen. Plot sometimes in Bullet gets a little bit hard to follow, and whether or not you're fully as invested as an audience member in the stakes of what's going on is questionable. Like, a lot of the time in Bullet, it's really just about the mood and the feel of the movie, at least in my opinion. But a film I think takes this new way of doing crime pictures, and, you know, uses concepts that are a bit of a throwback but also being very modern at the same time is Le Samurai, which I believe is by Godard.
I think that's Melville.
Oh, shit. Okay. Either way, one of those French New Wave guys. I do get them all mixed up sometimes.
Yeah. They're a bit similar.
Well, I don't know. You could probably get a lot of Nouvelle Vague heads banging on your door with baguettes. I think Le Samurai does it perfectly, because Le Samurai has a really good, exciting plot. It's got great soul and, long moments of introspection and that sort of quiet that this film also searches for. But just feels more of a complete piece.
Yeah, this film does. The film, I mean, point blank, just ends, but there's not really a conclusion,
right? Like, which I think is quite a
film noir-esque kind of feel.
It's a little bit of a, well, film noirs always have a conclusion of sorts. Normally, it's a bleak one, but there's this idea of just leaving things hanging and leaving you feeling like the story continues, or the misery continues. It does. That has a quality that that I think was very fashionable as the 70s came on. And that's why I think this film is enormously influential. Like, I look at this film and then I look at something like The Parallax View with Warren Beatty.
That's such a nihilistic film.
Yeah, right. And it's like, but it totally takes a leaf out of Point Blank's book, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that I think that there are a ton of movies in the 70s that do that. The classic 70s thrillers. And that allow themselves to be more creative. So I think the film should also be heralded for what an influence it clearly had.
I think that's important in many ways, because, you know, a lot of filmmakers, if you look at some people like Steven Soderbergh, they took that film and, you know, and put it into their own films. So this movie does have, like, a legacy because it carries on into the films that it inspired.
Yeah, and I think that it's kind of commitment to simultaneously presenting us with these incredible visuals while also taking a kind of a jab at the modern world is also to be commended. And I think, and that again, this is the modern American, the new what is it called, the modern American filmmakers or whatever, this is that
new Hollywood,
the new Hollywood, exactly, the film school brats, you know, this is all that, that's all gonna start coming down the pike. And I think that these guys, so many of these guys, be they Martin Scorsese or whoever, are looking at old Hollywood while thinking very much about how to forge new paths. So I think that there's a great deal in this film that sort of speaks to that. Anyway, I mean, I think everyone should watch it. I'm not sure it's going to be my favorite film of all time, but I'm saying, you know, it's a great film in its own right. I think it just needs to be understood as a bit of not an experiment, but as it kind of have to be understood on its own terms, I think.
Yeah.
It's probably the best generous way of putting it. And it's interesting to think about this in relationship to the last episode we did on Heat as well. It takes a lot to do a really good crime picture.
Yeah, I think these days it's very difficult to try and do like a proper crime movie because it's already been done so many other times before. It's like, how can you do that, make it new?
Well, I mean, I think that was the case in 1967 as well. I think it is a hard, when a genre is that when a genre has been done that much, and they've been making, there's never been a period where crime pictures were out of fashion. Think about that, where thrillers or cops and robbers stuff was not in fashion, unlike the Western or sci-fi or even musicals. Like that, they've just been consistent since the very dawn of cinema.
Yeah, it's true.
So it's tough. Oof. Anyway.
You ever meet Walker?
He makes my flesh crawl.
What do you really want?
I really want my money.
I want my 93 grand.
I want my money.
So, birthdays and recommendations now. I'm going to recommend you Deliverance by John Borman.
Hey, there we go. I still haven't seen that, so
That is a very good film. And he was nominated for Best Picture and Best Director for that film.
Great. No, I definitely want to check that out.
It's really worth a watch. I think there's
Is it very scary?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's a little... It has its little... It's not like boo scary kind of thing, but it's disturbing in a lot of ways. And also it's, you know, it has its moments where it's like a bit like... It makes you feel a bit uneasy and leaves sort of feeling like, ugh, like guilty of something, because like the whole movie deals with like a lot of things and, you know, the bad side of people and things like that. And also it's very well directed and has, I think, a lot of the sort of directing kind of style from Point Blank is kind of put into this, but on a less experimental stage.
Right. Did you say you'd seen Hell in the Pacific?
No, I hadn't seen
Hell in the Pacific. Oh, well, there you go. Well, I'll recommend you Hell in the Pacific then, which is a cracking watch, and again has, has a certain sense in which it really is about the characters and the more than that is the plot. And there's some very original editing in there as well. But it's a bit more of a stripped down film than Point Blank, and it's a bit of a half and half movie as well. Like half the film is this American Marine and a Japanese soldier kind of going at each other, and then the other half is them working together, and then at the end they fall out again. It's sort of another one of those slightly ambiguous endings, and you really get the sense that this is like that Marvin is working through some shit, you know, mm-hmm. during this. So it's a really good movie. There's not another war film like it, and it's a really interesting exploration of that particular side of the Second World War, which is not explored as much. And of course the Japanese dialogue in the film isn't subtitled, so
really
which I think is great, and so Japanese audiences watched it thinking more from Toshiro's point of view, and the American audiences were from Lee Marvin's point of view, and and I think you probably watch a version with Japanese subtitles, but I think having that lack of understanding is kind of crucial to the to understand comprehending the film.
Yeah. Cool. A bit of a Borman double bill for
right,
us.
Right, yeah.
So, birthdays now. Top of the list. Happy birthday to a guy who made the rounds on the internet when he said some stuff about Marvel movies. Happy birthday to Martin Scorsese.
Whoop.
Happy birthday to Rachel McAdams, who's mostly well known for The Notebook, but has gone off and done some pretty good films, such as Spotlight, which she was nominated for an Oscar.
Oh, yeah, I thought that she was good in that.
Yeah, and she was really good in a film called Red Eye, which it deals with that whole thing about, like, oh, God, I really hope the person sitting next to me on a plane is not a creep.
She's in Midnight in Paris as well, right?
Yes, she is.
Yeah, wonderful.
That's a good film. Happy birthday to Danny DeVito.
Oh, I love Danny DeVito.
He's great. I like him.
Such a good actor. I had not realised he was in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest when I saw it. And it was such a delight to see him in this younger incarnation. In fact, as it was with so many people in that film. And,
yeah, Christopher Lloyd's in that movie.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah. I mean, he's another one of these kind of forces of nature, even though he's very, very, very diminutive. You know, like, it might not be a good film if Danny DeVito's in it, but it's going to be more fun.
Yeah. And he was in one of the films that we talked about on the podcast, Get Shorty.
Right.
Yeah.
God, that was ages ago.
He also has been a director as well. He directed Matilda, and then he also directed the Hoffa movie with Jack Nicholson playing Jimmy Hoffa.
Interesting.
Happy birthday to Sophie Marceau, who was a Bond girl in World Is Not Enough.
Bond girl and bad girl.
Yeah, she played Elektra. What do you think about World Is Not Enough? Do you like it?
I need to rewatch it. I found it a lot of fun when it came out. There are some bits in it that are definitely like cringy as all hell, but but is that, you know, like for the Pierce Brosnan era, it's definitely not as bad as Die Another Day.
Yeah, true. Happy birthday to Carol Hayward, who was the second lead in Moonrise Kingdom. She was the girl in that film.
Oh, yeah, she's really good in that. Has she done anything else since?
Let's just double check. Yeah, she's done a fair... Oh, she was in Isle of Dogs. Her voice was in Isle of Dogs.
Right.
She was also in Manchester by the Sea.
Oh, look at that.
And she was in Patterson, the Jim Jarmusch film. Oh, she was in Us.
Okay, oh, right. Okay, so lots to see there. Well, I'm glad she's having such a successful time of it.
True that. That's true.
So, no, wonderful.
Happy birthday to one of my favourite character actors working today, Stephen Root, who most people will recognize from many films, one of which is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where he plays the blind radio DJ or whatever it is.
Yeah, he's also in Get Out, right?
Yeah, he is in Get Out, that's true.
Yeah, I think he's in a bunch of stuff. He might even be in The West Wing at some point. I mean, everyone's in The West Wing, but
yeah, he's been in a lot of movies.
Yeah, so no, he's really great. You'd be one of those you recognize from places like Fargo. I know, remember he's in an episode of that, and yeah, so no, a really good like reliable presence. Character actor.
Happy birthday to Mary Elizabeth how the fuck do you say her last name?
Mastrantonio,
who played Maid Marian in the Robin Hood Prince of Thieves movie, and also in The Abyss, which
she played Maid Marian in The Abyss.
No, well, she played Lindsay in the James Cameron movie, The Abyss. And you're aware of The Abyss, right?
Not really.
You know, the film, like, because basically James Cameron, that was his, like, third movie he did after Aliens. And basically everybody fucking hated James Cameron on that film. Like, Ed Harris refuses to talk about that film because of the experience of working on that film and also nearly drowning on that film.
Right, Jesus Christ.
Because there was one time, because I read on IMDb, he, like, he pulled over to the side of the road and just burst into tears after, like, driving from work and stuff. And then it's the film that has, like, you know, the famous t-shirt, like, I survived the abyss. And there's a very well-known scene with Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, where Ed Harris is sort of resuscitating her, and it's a really kind of emotional moment in the movie. And they did so many takes of this, and it just got too much for her, that she said to James Cameron, "We are not animals."
Right. Yeah, I mean, he sounds like a twat, doesn't he, James Cameron? So.
Yeah. Happy birthday to stunt woman Zoe Bell, who has worked primarily as a stunt woman in quite a few of Tarantino's movies.
Oh, yes, of course. And she's in Whip It.
Yes, she is. And she was... she's done a few things outside. I think she's done a few things outside of, like, Tarantino's stuff. But yeah, she was Cate Blanchett's stunt double in Thor Ragnarok, and she's done a bunch of other movies, which is pretty awesome. But yeah, she was basically, I think the first job that she got was she was a stunt double in Xena, but the first film was Kill Bill. She was the stunt double for Uma Thurman.
Yeah, well, I really liked her in Whip It. She was really nice present.
Happy birthday to actor Rock Hudson.
Rock Hudson, yeah. He had a sad fate. He died of AIDS, of course. And really interesting, like, sort of not the world's best actor, but he definitely did some roles that are very memorable. I mean, one of the ones that springs to mind is All That Heaven Will Allow with All That Heaven Allows, even with what's her name? Jane Wyman? wonderful. Oh gosh, what's the director's name?
Douglas Sirk.
Douglas Sirk. Thank you. I was blanking on the director.
Yeah, Ron. Yeah, he played Ron.
The Heaven and Us. Yeah, he plays the gardener who has an affair with.
It's Jane Wyman. Yeah, that's
Jane Wyman. There we go. Yes, wonderful.
Mm.
Ah, so nothing wrong with.
Yeah, well, he worked a lot. He did a lot of movies with Doris Day.
Yes, in the 60s. Yeah, he did. And a very interesting film called The Undefeated with John Wayne. Very peculiar little Western that we should probably discuss at some point.
Yeah, that would be quite fun. Happy birthday to actor Peter Cook, who is in the great film The Princess Bride, where he says... Marriage.
Oh yes, of course. Peter Cook is that's yes.
Marriage is what brings us together today.
Yeah, no, brilliant comedian.
Yeah, and then I stole that from the wedding speech that I did at your wedding. Happy birthday to actor, teacher Lee Strasberg, who came out of retirement to be in The Godfather Part 2, where he played Hyman Roth.
Right. I mean, like, essentially he is not in any films, but he was Al Pacino's coach, and
yeah,
Pacino got him to be in The Godfather Part 2, and he absolutely nails that role.
Yeah, and he was Oscar nominated. And
yeah.
And basically, you know, I think it's like, you know, the Lee Strasberg Theater is, you know, ongoing.
Oh, yeah. No, a huge influence on screen acting. Definitely. Father to any number of unbearable method wankers. But I'm kidding. Like, he's really important.
Yeah. I think his character in Godfather Part 2 was based off Meyer Lansky.
Yes, I believe that's
one
the case.
Of the sort of the godfather of the godfathers.
The godfather of the godfathers, right?
Yeah. Happy birthday to Lorne Michaels, who started Saturday Night Live, and a lot of, you know, great comedic actors came out of that. Happy birthday to Roland Jaffé, an English director who directed The Killing Fields, The Scarlet Letter with, I think, Daniel Day-Lewis is in that. No, Gary Oldman's in that, one of those guys. And directed a really good film called The Mission with Robert De Niro and Jeremy Irons. And
oh, I've seen The Mission. Is it really good? It's sort of a bit...
It's okay.
Weird. Yeah, yeah. No, it is... yeah, it's a good watch. I don't know how, like, amazing it is.
Yeah.
Music's very good.
The Ennio Morricone music is fantastic. Happy birthday to Terry, who is the most famous dog in the world, who was the dog in The Wizard of Oz.
Is he the most famous dog in the world?
Well, one of them.
Really? In the days... Because, I don't, you know, Terry existed in the days before social media. I think there are dog influencers on Instagram that are more famous than Terry.
Yeah.
And it's Toto in the film, right?
Toto, yeah.
Right.
Toto? I don't think we're in Kansas anymore. Happy birthday to John Avnet, who directed one good film, Fried Green Tomatoes at Whistle Stop Cafe, and then didn't exactly have the same amount of success afterwards. And one of the films that he did direct was the second film that De Niro and Pacino were in.
Righteous Kill. Righteous Kill. See, it all comes back around.
Yeah, exactly. He directed Al Pacino in another film called 88 Minutes, which was not very good.
Right.
Oh, and happy birthday to Ralph Garman, who he's in Ted. He plays Mark Wahlberg's dad in that film. He has that great line where he goes,
"Oh, Jesus, fuck.
Yeah. Jesus H, fuck.
Oh, Jesus H, fuck."
But he co-hosts the Hollywood Babylon podcast with Kevin Smith.
Cool.
Has starred in a bunch of his movies. Oh, it's Jonathan Ross's birthday today.
Ah, was he?
I'm just gonna say happy birthday to the next person. Happy birthday to Stephen E. D'Souza, who was the writer of many great action classics: Commando, 48 Hours, and our favorite, Die Hard.
Ah, brilliant! Yeah. Oh, well, good for him.
Yeah. Oh, another screenwriter which was famous for one screenplay, wrote a screenplay for one of my favorite horror movies, Bill Lancaster, who was the son of Burt Lancaster. And he wrote the screenplay for John Carpenter's The Thing.
Well, there you go. I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
Even deserted Alcatraz Island is not immune to Walker's vengeance.
Bad man, Walker, a very destructive man. Why do you run around doing things like this?
Feel the blast of emotions at point-blank range.
What do you want from me, Walker? You're supposed to be dead.
Well, I've got a plane to catch, so...
Yeah, I've got to get you to the airport on time.
Was that a church on time?
Yeah.
Reference. Okay, great. Yeah, I got married ages ago. Let's move on.
All right. But thank you very much for listening to us talking about Point Blank. I never once said Point Break.
That's true. I'm glad we avoided that. Gosh. Well, yeah. Let's just go through it again while you edit it, because I'm not sure I would have caught that given my state at the moment.
Or Gross Point Blank.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Which would have been interesting.
Yes. Which is also a great movie.
Mm, good comedy. But yeah, so do check it out if you are near a DVD store or have an Amazon account. Do get a hold of the DVD and do check it out for yourself, because it is worth watching. It has its qualities that are really good, and like we said, it has some things that could have been needing a little bit more. But yeah, it's definitely worth a watch. And if especially if you're a fan of Lee Marvin and if you're a fan of like hard boiled action thrillers like that, then
it's like for me, it's like pure. It's Lee Marvin in his purest form.
Yeah, exactly. Back in his like on top form. So yeah, you could follow us on Twitter at Holmes Movies Pod. You can also follow me on Twitter at Fabricius91, Fabricius91. And you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn.
Everywhere. We're everywhere.
Everywhere.
Give us lots of ratings and reviews, please, that are all good.
That would be very nice. And you can also send us an email to holmesmoviespodcast@gmail.com. And we also have a blog, a WordPress blog, which we put up reviews and all sorts of film-related goodiness. And
what's the address for that?
Holmes Movies... I think it's holmesmovies.wordpress.com.
Right, people can find it.
We'll link it in the episode description. So that's all there. And I'll post in the blog that you did with Andrew,
We haven't updated that for ages. Anyway. Okay, well, I better go.
Yes, gotta fly.
Yes.
Yes, I've been Anders Holmes.
I have been a sniffly Adam Holmes. See you again soon.
Bye.
Know the mental agony that overwhelms and consumes at point-blank range. Experience rapid-fire action at point-blank range.
Things aren't done this way anymore, Walker. Let's be reasonable.